First, according to Johns Hopkins University, the number of deaths from the novel coronavirus has gone over 85,000 in the U.S., about 430 of those here in Wisconsin. There's no vaccine for COVID-19 and no medication is being recommended for treatment. A couple of malaria drugs and an antiviral drug have been approved for severe cases as a last resort. Researchers are testing a variety of other options. One group of doctors called the Frontline COVID-19 Critical Care Working Group says it's come up with an effective treatment that reduces the need for ventilators. Dr. Pierre Corey is a member of that group. He is a pulmonary and critical care medicine specialist. He's also an associate professor of medicine in the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Corey, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, Rob, thanks for having me. I just want to say one thing, Rob. I want to emphasize I'm speaking as a member of the Frontline Critical Care Working Group. Although I'm still on faculty at the university, I did recently resign effective June 30th, so I don't want to have an affiliation with that School of Medicine there.
Thank you for that correction. Now, when people come into a hospital, COVID-19, before we get into the regimen you're working on here, can you talk about the typical treatment for those patients?
Yeah, so did you ask before they get to the hospital or when they get to the hospital?
When they arrive at the hospital. So they're in that more severe case of COVID-19.
Yeah. So people who meet criteria for hospitalization, generally at this point, the most common is that they have some need for oxygen or an oxygen requirement. They're short of breath enough and their lungs are dysfunctional enough that they need some oxygen. The treatment for such patients, I just have to say, it varies. There's really no standard, generally accepted treatment. And that's the challenge. Most of the world, most of the health societies going into this recommended what we call standard supportive care, which we're very good at delivering, support people with hydration when they needed oxygen, ventilators if their lungs fail further. But no real specific therapies. There's a bunch of options. The evidence for them really varies to very weak to maybe compelling, but there's really no standard therapy. And I've been talking to people all around the country, and I'm in New York City right now. I'm running an ICU in COVID. I took a leave from the university I'm a New Yorker, so I came back home. And so I've been sort of drowning in COVID patients, and I'm seeing what's happening on the wards, and it really varies. The drugs that are being tried are different dosages, types, and durations. And so, basically my point is it's nothing standard yet.
We're winging it for the most part, it sounds like.
People are trying to, they're using clinical reasoning, impressions. There's a lot being spread around in our doctor world, through many different means, not only publications, but, even WhatsApp and social media, and lots of folks are sharing their experiences. And it does seem to be a signal that some things seem to be working. So I can talk about those that generally that we hear are working.
Yeah, so you and this group, and this is frontline medical people around the country, some from around the world, I think, have this this protocol. Can you talk about what you're doing?
Yeah, so the five of us got together. So we're colleagues. We have some shared interests. We're all intensive care unit specialists, and we've either published or have publications in the same area. And we've become many of us collegial and even friends over time. And so we have a lot of clinical discussions. And when we came together early on, all of us just had this, natural response of like immediately trying to figure out COVID. We just sort of vacuumed up, publications, discussions. As the patients started coming into our ICUs, we were on the phone all the time, talking about what their progression trajectories were like, the medicines we were using, and how it was working. And so, we just tried to come up with a protocol. And, as I mentioned, I was interviewed the other day, and I sort of said the same thing is that, generally, doctors look for guidance from major publications, major trials that are published, randomized controlled trials, and/or societies which, compile those trials, analyze them, and they get some experts to provide guidance. And that typical approach, that really works in more peacetime and not in war. I mean, right now we're at war. We just really got attacked by this virus. It overwhelmed hospitals. And so we just don't have that ability. And I don't think any of those structures are capable of coming up with a treatment protocol. So the five of us said, let's figure out what's working. Let's put something out there that we think helps. And that's what we've done. And so we sort of somewhat clunkily, but I guess it works. We've called our protocol the Math Plus Protocol. It's an acronym. And first and foremost, the most important is what we think is methylprednisolone. So it's a corticosteroid. And there's a lot of rationale for use. we found that one of my partners, a doctor named Umberto Maduri, he's sort of world famous expert on corticosteroids and critical illness. He and five others, Dr. Pastoris from Sloan Kettering in New York City, and some Italian and also Spanish authors, they got together and they actually reviewed the world's literature on the prior influenza and SARS and MERS pandemics, which were also coronaviruses. And they found, contrary to some of the big health societies, they actually found in the biggest trials and the most controlled trials that steroids are actually life-saving in moderate to severe illness in all of those pandemics. So we already have evidence from prior pandemics that corticosteroids are helpful and actually reduce mortality. And so we put that in our protocol. And then a really another interesting paper came out, which I can't stop talking about, but there's a company called Advaita Bioinformatics, and they put out a paper a week ago where they looked at sort of the pattern of gene activation that SARS-CoV initiates in the human cell when it infects a human cell. And that's like actually publicly available data where you can see the patterns of gene activation. So genes control, most of the genes that are activated in this disease control what are called cytokines or chemokines. And those substances, they just promote lots and lots of inflammation. So what we're seeing with these patients is they're hyperinflamed. And this company actually mapped out all the medicines that suppress different genes. And they tried to match the best medicine with the, you know, that most closely matched all the ones that were activated by the virus. And that medicine was methylprednisolone. It was really interesting that that was the best corticosteroid. We had chosen it because we know that it's the most effective in the lung. It reaches the highest concentrations in the lung. And since all these patients are presenting with invariably lung disease, we use methylprednisolone. That seems to be working. The next component, right, on the math plus of the A is ascorbic acid. Other people, some people know it as vitamin C. I like to use the word ascorbic acid because it's really a really profound, has a really profound physiologic potency when used in high doses and given intravenously. You cannot achieve what we achieve through oral means. So taking as many tablets as you want won't do it. We know that when you deliver to high levels in the blood, it actually works what we call synergistically with the steroids. They both have, they both kind of make each other stronger. And what ascorbic acid does, it has many, many different effects, but one is controlling inflammation as well as modulating the immune response. And so, and then with steroids, it actually protects all the blood vessels from, you know, all the immune cells leaving and attacking the organs. It also prevents fluid from leaving, protects the function of blood vessels. And then other things that we have on there are like heparin. So heparin, that was sort of an easy one. This disease, very early on, everybody started noticing at the bedside that we were just seeing lots more clotting than in other diseases, like significantly more. And then very quickly, publications came out showing higher levels of clotting than we'd normally seen. And then, a lot of suggestive papers started coming out showing that those who are on blood thinners of varying amounts, either, you know, moderate prophylaxis or full treatment doses, generally tended to do better and actually survive to much greater extent. And so basically, we're just trying to attack the inflammation and the clotting with our protocol. And then we have a few other supplements that we think are helpful. You know, hydroxychloroquine is on our protocol, although we're very measured in how we're recommending it. We think that it likely has benefit, but certainly not in the hospital. So we actually had some debate about whether we should include it, because it's really, we think if it's going to work at all, it's going to work early on as an outpatient when you first get symptoms. That's where most antivirals are effective. You know, once you're 5, 7, 10 days into an illness, we don't think it's helpful. In fact, it's been shown to be harmful and ineffective in the hospital. So I want to be clear, that's not what we're recommending in the hospital.
And I want to bring up a point. Sometimes when there are promising studies that come out into the media and we in the media share them, people think, I need to go out and buy these substances for self-treatment. I'm guessing for most of these substances you're talking about, that's not what we want to do.
No, right? I mean, you know, I try to use, you know, promises of things working is one thing. Having a strong scientific rationale and a good sense of risk benefit. So, you know, if you're going to try something, I don't want to say on a lark, but on a rationale, generally we're more comfortable as physicians if it has a very good safety profile. So if the benefits, the theoretical benefits far outweigh the risk, many of us physicians, you know, all physicians vary by their not only the estimation of the risk benefit, but their willingness to accept risk in certain instances. And I'll say we our group probably became much more willing to try things on a rationale only because of one thing. which is it seemed that supportive care only strategies in this disease was leading to just incredible morbidity and mortality. And, you know, when everybody was dying at the great extent that we're seeing, particularly in New York, and there's definitely been regional variation, and not everyone has reported the same high mortality rates, but in New York, it's been pretty consistent around the city. I have friends in hospitals running ICUs all around the city, and we're all basically saying the same story. And so for us, trying nothing seemed pretty unacceptable. These patients are really sick, and we wanted to try to help them. And we're using medicines that we've used for years in many diseases. We know their safety profiles. They're all FDA approved. They're generally benign, you know, with the exception of maybe blood thinners, you can run into trouble. But we really, you know, there has been a couple of bleeding complications, but generally we're seeing patients do better on these medicines.
Dr. Corey, that's all the time we have. Thanks for joining us today.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Pierre Corey is a critical care medicine specialist. He's a member of the Frontline COVID-19 Critical Care Working Group. We talked to him about his group's treatment and recommendations for severe coronavirus cases in hospitals.